You know, we've been looking at Paul's life, and we spent a lot of time sort of the backstory. It's interesting as we think about Paul that we know, which is Paul of the journeys, Luke only devotes four chapters of 28 on that. 16, 17, 18, 19. 16, where we were last week, where was Paul? Final exam. Starts with a P. Philippi. Today he's at Thessaloniki or Thessalonica, depending how you pronounce it. Then he'll be at next week at Corinth and then at Ephesus. And so those are the four deals. So today we continue the story of Paul's second journey. This is his second stop. This is the city of Thessalonica, or if you're there, they call it Thessaloniki. So as he did in Philippi, Luke's going to give us two stories. One of the stories is that, again, like we found at Philippi, we got the founding of the church. And given that it's Paul, once again, Paul gets invited to leave. This is a recurring theme in Paul's life. I hope he could handle rejection pretty well. Okay. So, Acts 17. After Paul and Silas passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessaloniki. There was a synagogue of the Jews, and Paul went in as was his custom. Being a Jew, it would be customary for a Jew to go into the synagogue. And on three Sabbath days, he argued with them from the Scriptures. This is how you get invited to go to the next town. You just argue with people, okay? Explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Messiah to suffer and to rise from the dead. Basic gospel teaching 101. And saying, this is the Messiah Jesus whom I am proclaiming to you. Some of them were persuaded. This is some of the Jewish community, Luke says, were persuaded to join Paul and Silas, as did a great many of devout, and we can read here basically Gentiles, Greeks, and not a few of the leading women. You may know from the from manuscript studies we studied, this is the passage that in later some of the ancient manuscripts got changed to the wives of leading men. You remember that story? Because somebody couldn't handle it, that we have leading women. Okay. But actually, Luke has that twice. But the Jews became jealous, and with the help of some ruffians in the marketplace, there always seem to be ruffians in the marketplace, they formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. While they were searching for Paul and Silas to bring them out to the assembly, they couldn't find them, so they attacked Jason's house. When they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some other believers before the city authorities, shouting, "These people who have been turning the world upside down." Let's see it again. The charge is, you're turning the world upside down. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. There's some reason for that. Have also come here also, and Jason has entertained them as guests. That's Jason's crime. They are acting contrary to the decrees of the emperor. We don't know of any decree that's true for, but you know, when you're worked up in something like that, you'll say anything. Saying that there's another king named Jesus. The people and the city officials were disturbed when they heard this, and after they had taken bail from Jason and the others, they let them go. Got off kind of light on that one. Now, there's a lot in this story, okay? Luke's view, kind of the typical scenario, is Paul's going to be going from large city to large city, actually Roman capital to Roman capital. He generally gets invited to leave, so he has to leave that territory, go into another jurisdiction. Where possible, he's going to go into a Jewish synagogue. Did he go into one in Philippi? No, because Luke does not mention that, and the archaeology has never found one there. And when Paul writes to that city, he doesn't mention anything Jewish or refer to Jewish scriptures. So obviously that's probably a Gentile congregation. Third thing he'll do is he accesses Jews or Gentile God-fearers in the synagogue. Now, historians have raised several questions about aspects of this presentation. Luke is an author, and authors take liberty as they tell their stories. So we're going to kind of look at some aspects of this, both in terms of Luke and in terms of Paul. The part that gets flagged is the Jewish part, because some historians would say that Luke probably may be more stylized than accurate on all the details here. So, first of all, there is no archaeological evidence of Jewish presence has been found in Thessalonica. This is the second time. Philippi, Thessalonica, doesn't mean it's not there. It just means we haven't found it so far. More importantly, all the evidence in 1 Thessalonians, which is the right, he goes from Thessaloniki to Corinth, and he's going to write back. And when he writes to the Thessaloniki church, all the evidence in this letter indicates that the church appears to be purely Gentile, not made up of any Jews. Paul gives no evidence that there's any Jews in the congregation. So, for example, and as he addresses the congregation, this is what he says, he's praising him, how you turn from God to God from idols to serve the living and true God. Now, who would you say that kind of a statement to? Who turns from idols? Do Jews turn from idols? Not if they're legitimately good Jews, you know. That'd be somewhat outside the box. So, again, it appears that Paul understands his congregation there to be Gentile. Might also explain, again, why we have no Old Testament references in 1 Thessalonians. And Paul also indicates that the persecution experienced in the church was from other Gentiles and not from the Jews. In Luke's version, it's the Gentiles who get upset with Paul. When Paul writes to the church, he seems to flag that it was the other Jews who were upset with him. So in 1 Thessalonians, Paul says this, speaking to the Gentiles there, you suffered the same things from your own compatriots as they did from the Jews, referring back to the earlier apostles. So looks like here Paul has in mind that we got a Gentile congregation that other Gentiles kind of got, and that Jews are simply not in the picture. In addition, there's two very good reasons for Paul would probably not be evangelizing Jews. Now, we've covered this before, but you may not have been here that week, or you may, like me, have slept since then and need a little bit of a reminder. So, first of all, as some of us know, Paul tells us in all of his letters, he clearly felt that he had been called by God as an apostle to the Gentiles, not to the Jews. He says this over and over. Here's one example from Galatians. God revealed his son to me so that I might proclaim him among the what? The Gentiles. And Paul's very consistent on that. Second, Paul tells us in Galatians that he made an agreement at Jerusalem. This is the Jerusalem conference. And that the part of the agreement was specifically he was not to go to the Jews. Whose job was that? Peter and the Jerusalem church. He was to go to another. So this is what he says in Galatians 2. I had been entrusted with the gospel to the Gentiles, just as Peter had been entrusted to the gospel of the Jews. Now, raises a question, if Paul has been called to evangelize Gentiles, not Jews, why would he hang around a Jewish synagogue? And many of you already know the answer to this, but again, it's worth looking at because some of us may not know this. As a Jew, Paul would like to go to synagogues to worship. He is a Jew. At this point, Paul does not see himself as anything other than a Jew. He's a Jew for Jesus. So if you're going to worship God, where would you do that? You'd go to synagogue to be with other Jews. In addition to that, Luke tells us that that's his custom, which makes sense. He's a Torah observant Jew himself. But secondly, there are good evangelistic reasons, as some of you know, why if you wanted to convert people, where is the one place in the world you're going to stand the best chance of doing that? Any of you guys in sales? Hot contacts? You know, you want the ones that are more primed to respond to you. These are the Gentiles that were in the synagogues. Luke has already referred to this. He referred to them as the God-fearers, Gentiles who, we know this from a variety of sources, they already got one foot in. They love the Jewish faith. They love the idea of one God. They love the ethical teaching. They like Judaism. They're not buying into the altering the human body for that. And that's really primarily from any of them the only thing, the only hurdle there. So these would be in anybody's book hot contacts. This is the prime group. Now, a little archaeology. Here's an inscription from a synagogue. What language is it in? It's in Greek, so this is out in the diaspora area. We know from, and there's a book called The Ancient Synagogue that really gets into this. Hundreds of these have survived, and what we know by studying them is that nearly half the people, you know, we have the naming opportunities in our church. Have you seen those, the plaques? That's what these are. These are the plaques that are left. And so people who study this say, well, it appears that nearly half of the people who built synagogues were God-fearers. They gave the money so that the construction could be done. And by the way, they also left there who the leaders are. And what they mention is about 1 in 5 of the leaders of a synagogue, this is interesting, are in fact not Jews. They are God-fearers. So God-fearers who've not been circumcised, have not become Jews, are supporting synagogues. They're building them. You may remember a couple of stories from the life of Jesus. Remember the centurion that he's been faithful to serve, you know, to serve God's people, supported. He even built the synagogue at that particular town. So that would be a biblical example of that. Now, Paul's focus on this group would explain the Jewish opposition that Luke mentions. Again, some of us know this, but it's worth looking at. If, as the archaeology indicates, the Gentile God-fearers are maybe even your primary financial benefactors, and if Paul is poaching them, how would you feel? If you really want to get somebody worked up, what do you threaten? Go where the money is. Okay, so a lot of scholarship indicates that this would be a good reason for people to be upset with him. So again, if he's trying to convert them to Christian Judaism, this could be perceived as a direct threat to the synagogue Jewish community, which would account for some other things that Paul says about his life. Both groups are essentially struggling for the same basic group of adherents. Now, historically, a little scholarship here, it is likely that even though no synagogue has been found, there was Jewish presence in Thessaloniki. Here's what we know from Roman authors and from multiple authors. There seems to have been no major city in the Roman Empire that did not have a sizable Jewish presence, just across the empire. So what's the likelihood that this one major Roman city capital would have no Jews in it? Given the location, probably none. So someday they may find a synagogue, we just haven't found it yet. So even though there's no archaeological evidence, again, found in every city, and we know that Paul went into synagogues. So now Paul admits this in the 2 Corinthians passage that we looked at earlier when he says this. 5 times I received from who? The Jews, 40 lashes minus one. By the way, that's the 39 lashes. Remember who else got those? Jesus at his trial. This is for the most part, it's what's called a synagogue punishment. This is a punishment you generally get at a synagogue, not with Jesus, but generally you would get this in the synagogue when you've done something to offend the Jewish law. Once I received stoning, who stones? Romans don't stone. Greeks don't stone. Who stones? Jews. And in danger from my own people. Who are his own people? It appears from Paul's own confessions that he ticked off a lot of Jews. You know, being lashes, being stoned, and in danger kind of thing. So all three of these references are Jewish references, and the lashes one in particular is associated with the synagogue. So Paul is admitting that he's going to synagogues, he's creating lots of problems, and he's getting fairly frequently a hostile response to that. Jewish names are rare in Paul's letters and churches, but they do exist. Remember Prisca and Aquila? Okay, and there's some others. So there are, although he's called to be an apostle to the Gentiles, by his own admission, he's spending time in Jewish synagogues, angering Jewish people, and he has some of his people he works with are from the Jewish community. So it's not quite cut and dried. Now, it's unlikely that Paul would have gone to the Jewish synagogue to convert Jews. So the emphasis on the Jewish evangelism, many scholars would think, may be more Luke than Paul. And so that aspect of the story is maybe less likely historically, more in tune with what Luke wants to say about Paul as he sort of summarizes. Now, here's a little surprise in this story. Luke indicates that Paul got in trouble with the local officials for political reasons and that he is a threat to Rome. Now, this is probably about the year 50-51. This is early. This is half a century before Revelation is written, in which Rome has clearly become an enemy. So this is awfully early for this thing to be emerging. They're accused of turning the whole world upside down. By the way, you think they're guilty of that? Christian values, Roman values? I'm thinking that's probably a fair assessment. They've acted contrary to the decrees of the emperor. Not sure what that is. Don't see anything in Paul's ministry explicitly that does that. Claiming there's another king named Jesus, well, that he's guilty of, as is the entire New Testament. So any of these charges would create serious problems for Rome. So that may be what Luke's getting at. So how long was Paul in Thessaloniki? This is another one of those deals where Luke and Paul probably have two different versions of this. Luke says he's there for three Sabbaths. That would be 2 or 3 weeks, depending on when it falls. But look what Paul says in Philippians when he sort of remembers back. When I was in Thessaloniki, you sent me help for my needs more than once. So Paul has to write a letter saying I need help, response back, do it again, response back, do it again. That might imply a little longer period. And by the way, in Thessalonians, he says this, you remember our labor and toil, brothers and sisters, we work night and day so that we might not burden any of you while we proclaim to you the gospel of God. Paul seems to indicate that he actually stayed there long enough to get a job and to work. Both of those things indicate scholars may think that this is one of those places where Luke may be sort of telescoping things to move the story along. But in fact, Paul may have been maybe at least a few months. Some would argue even longer than that, but at least a few months. Maybe Luke is moving the story along. Now, Jason posted bail for Paul. And this is one of the most interesting things in the story. In our world, why do you post bail? What's that? Get out of jail, and then why? What's the purpose of the bail? We don't want you to run off. You know, somebody's going to forfeit here. This, interesting enough, is reverse bail. We're going to pay money to guarantee that Paul leaves. Okay. Not intended to stay, guarantee they leave, you know. Jason, you're going to, if we find Paul stuck around here, you're going to lose all that money, so you're motivated. Now, the pattern then repeats in the town of Berea. It's interesting if you do Journeys of Paul. In Thessaloniki, there's not much. In Berea, there's nothing. There is a sign that says Paul was here. I'm not making that up. It's on a corner. There's a building there. And there's a little deal. It's got some mosaics in it. And said Paul was here, sort of commemorates that. Which is why on some of the trips we go to actually Meteora rather than that.
Is the sign in English?
You know, I'm not motivated to revisit it just to find out. I bet you can Google images. I bet you can find that out. That's a good question. I'm not sure on that. So we'll just move right along to Berea. Okay. Another place. By the way, this is a ruin outside of town of Berea. That very night, the believers sent Paul and Silas off. This is the reverse bail. Get them out. Go to Berea so we can get our money back. When they arrived, they went to a Jewish synagogue. Typical Lucan kind of narrative. These Jews were more receptive than those in Thessaloniki, for they welcomed the message very eagerly and examined the scriptures every day to see whether these things are so. So they're taking Paul seriously, as did a great many of the devout Greeks. And here we go again. Leading women of the community buying in. But when the Jews from Thessaloniki, Paul is a motivational speaker. He motivates people so much with anger that they follow him to the next town just to harass him. When the Jews at Thessaloniki learned that the word of God had been proclaimed by Paul and Berea as well, they came there too to stir up and incite the crowds. They are not going to let this go. Then the believers immediately sent Paul away to the coast. But Silas and Timothy remained behind. So this is sort of the track you can see where Paul's journey is going to be. Now, this is interesting. Sends Paul and Silas off to Berea. Berea lay outside Thessaloniki's jurisdiction, so it looks like he left Philippi to a different political jurisdiction, Thessaloniki. Then he gets to another political jurisdiction, Berea, which, by the way, meet the conditions of the reverse bail. And by him going there, then, you know, Jason can get his money back. It's interesting that Timothy and Silas are exempt and that they're allowed to say, and I was reading one commentary said, what this really seems to indicate is the locals that identified of the team, who is the troublemaker? Paul is the identified troublemaker. So now we're going to travel to Athens, where we have one of the great stories of Luke. They brought Athens as far Paul as far as Athens after receiving instructions to have Silas and Timothy join him as soon as possible. They left him. Now, we're probably meant to understand this is some type of a written communication, which is interesting because one of the really weird things about Luke and about Acts, we know Paul mostly from his letters, right? Okay. Luke never mentions that Paul wrote a thing. It's just one of those weird things. Luke does not seem to know about Paul the writer, which is one of those kind of kind of disconnects. This is as close as Luke will get to talking about Paul's letter writing. So just for a second, let's just kind of think about this. This type of communication that Luke is writing about, that you're going to send a letter back and forth, is the kind of thing that Paul did a lot of, and we know that. For example, in 1 Thessalonians, he said this, I solemnly command by the Lord that this letter be read to all of them. So he intends for it to be shared. Colossians, we have that sort of expanded. When this letter has been read among you, have it read also in the church of Laodiceans, and see that this letter is also read from Laodicea, so that these things are to be shared. They're very quickly collected. As a matter of fact, the evidence indicates that the earliest scripture that's New Testament, the first writings that become really have status, may likely be the letters of Paul, even before the Gospels. So we have this wonderful statement in 2 Peter. Most scholars would put 2 Peter written no later than 120. It's maybe the last thing written in the New Testament, and this is what this writer says. Paul wrote to you according to the wisdom given to him, speaking of this as he does in what? This seems to be an indication that Paul's letters, we don't know what's in them, but there seems to be a collection of them, his letters as a group. Then we have this. There are some things in them hard to understand, which the ignorant and unstable twist to their own destruction. That's not changed in 2,000 years. As they do the other, probably indication by 120, Paul's letters have been collected. Whether it's the exact same group we got, we don't know, but there's a collection of them, and they clearly have the status of Scripture. So these communications that Luke's alluding to become actually real critical. In the later generation, it's Paul's letters mostly. So now we wind up in Athens in a great story. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was deeply distressed to see that the city was full of idols. Have you been to Athens? Acropolis, what are in all those buildings? Yeah, gods, depending what your view. Then down at the bottom, down the forum down there in the valley, you've been down there, what's all those things full of? Every god you can name. And Athens was, by the way, known the intro of this. So being Paul, he does not discuss, he argues in the synagogue of the Jews. Now, this is a little odd. I don't think he's going to get a lot of argument with the Jews about idols. But we'll go with the story. And the devout persons. And also in the marketplace every day, and that would be full of those things, with those who happen to be there. Epicurean? Anybody remember Epicurean? Mm-hmm. What is their basic philosophical position? Eat, drink, and be merry. Yeah, basic on physical pleasure. Okay. Stoic philosophers? The exact opposite, you know, deny yourself. These are just represented. There were many others. Some said, what does this blabber, it's a good description of Paul, want to say? Others said, he seemed to be a proclaimer of foreign divinities. Not quite sure what he's talking about. This was because he was telling the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. By the way, anything in the Greek world or Roman world about resurrection of the dead? Yeah, not a big one. That's more of a Jewish belief, although there's some stories that could be interpreted that way. So they took him and brought him to the Areopagus. Does anybody remember what the Areopagus is famous for? If a person really, really offends you and you want to kill him, you take him up on top and you kill him. It had been used for that for centuries, okay? It's also a place where the city council met. It's also a place of great debate. May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting. So we buy into the sort of the debate discussion here. But remember, there's a cliff over there. So if the discussion does not go well, we have an out here. It sounds rather strange to us. So we would like to know what it means, this new gospel that you're preaching. Now, all the Athenians and the foreigners living there would spend their time in nothing but telling and hearing something new. You know, they just love to debate that. Now, a couple of confirmations. Paul confirms in 1 Thessalonians that he didn't spend time in Athens. Therefore, when we could bear it no longer, we decided to be left alone in Athens. So Paul confirms this. Now, the Areopagus, also known as Mars Hill, they're in fact the exact same thing. If you go there, that's sort of at the base of the Acropolis, just over off to the side. They bring in there to the city council meet, traditional place of debate, and also a good exit strategy if you don't like what you hear. It's interesting. He's not arrested, but he seems to be an object of curiosity. He's got this new strange something, and they kind of want to hear what it is. And so this gives Paul and Acts a chance to give a speech. By the way, you can see the forum down below down there, along with some churches and some modern buildings. A little bit of a long reading, but it's an interesting reading. When Paul stood in front of the Areopagus, he said, Athenians, you always want to lead with flattery, right? Yeah, you can lead with some flattery here. Athenians, I see how extremely religious you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at the objects of your worship, I found among them an altar with the inscription to the unknown God. One of the great archaeological discoveries, that's it. That's an altar to the unknown God discovered at this location. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. And now he's going to give content to it. The God who made the world and everything in it, he is the Lord of heaven and earth. What is that? Judaism 101. Nothing Christian about this. Judaism 101. The Lord of heaven and earth, the creator God. The God who made the world and everything in it, who is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in shrines made with human hands. Do you remember somebody got in trouble for saying that? Stephen got stoned for saying that. And he was actually just quoting scripture. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything. Sort of making a mockery of the gods. Since he himself gives to all mortals life and breath and all things. From one ancestor he made all nations to inhabit the whole earth. That's a reference to Adam. Genesis story, so we're still narrating our Jewish history. He allowed the times and their existence to the boundaries of the places where they would live so that they would search for God and perhaps grope for him and find him. This is the developing argument. So that they would search for God, grope for God, perhaps find God, though indeed he is not far from each one of us. For quotation marks, in him we live and move and have our being. Anybody know why the quotation marks are there? It's a very famous quotation from a Greek philosopher. Think about that for a second. Paul, according to Luke, is quoting Greek philosophy. As even some of your own poets have said, for we too are his offspring. Another quote, I can't remember what they're from. Thucydides or everybody, it's a couple of that. Since we are God's offspring, we ought not to think that the deity is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed in the art. We're still hanging here, Judaism 101. The one true God, creator of heaven and earth. We don't worship representations. We don't worship idols. While God has overlooked the times of foreign human ignorance, now to follow this argument, because we're going to flip to Romans here in just a second. While God has overlooked the times of human ignorance, now he commands all people everywhere to repent because he has fixed the day on which he would have the world judged in righteousness. And what is that a reference to? The day of the Lord. Again, not the Christian version. We're still like in the book of Daniel or some other books. It's the day of the Lord. Okay. By a man whom he appointed, And of this he has given assurance to all by raising from him from the dead. So we now link the story of Jesus into the Jewish proclamation. When they heard of the resurrection of the day, they just scoffed. But others said, talk a little bit more about this. At that point, Paul left them. They invite him. Commentators comment that maybe what's going on here, that we will hear you again about this, may have not been a really authentic request, but more disingenuous type of thing, so that Paul saw through that and then walked away. But some of them joined him and became believers, including a guy who in later tradition becomes very, very famous, Dionysius the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others among them. Pretty specific. You get a couple of individuals named, and then others. Now, again, the altar to the unknown God, for a long time people kind of wondered about that, and then one day they were digging around, and sure enough, that thing did in fact exist. It has been dug up, and it's now in a museum, so Luke's dead on about that. Now, there's reason to believe that Paul's speech, Theophagus, may not be historical in all of its details the way that Luke has written it, but this may be one of those places where Luke kind of crafts the story. For one thing, in Paul's letters, how many times does he quote a Greek philosopher? Goose egg. None. Okay. But we know from Luke that he loves to quote ancient authorities. So that might feel a little bit more like him. Paul's speech also appears to be modeled on the speech of Socrates. And where was Socrates killed? Athens. Remember the Socrates story? Very famous story. The charge against Paul is proclaiming foreign deities. That is the charge leveled against Socrates. And it's the most famous trial in Athens history, and it's considered to be the greatest single blunder Athens ever made. So kind of frame that for a second. Luke appears to be portraying Paul as a modern Socrates, noble, innocent, victimized, and if you reject him, it's just like you rejected Socrates. You have made a huge mistake. So some scholars indicate this may be more the literary craft of Luke. Luke wants us to know that in rejecting Paul, the Athenians have screwed up once again. Okay, now, it could be, if you follow this argument, that Luke is following the famous dictum by Thucydides, the famous Greek writer who wrote the history of the Peloponnesian War. And some of you have seen this before, but I find it hilarious. This is what he said. This is what he says about, this is what writers of the ancient world do. As to the speeches which were made either before or during the war, it was hard for me and for others who reported them to me to remember. Anybody else have that problem? Okay, I don't know. Okay. Therefore I expressed, as I thought he would be likely to have expressed them. I'll go with that, okay. Though it's shaped by Luke, on the other hand, the content of the speech seems to have some very genuine Pauline elements. For example, in Romans, Paul makes the same argument that Luke says Paul made in Athens. So I thought that was worth looking at. For this is Paul talking to the Gentiles who are now Christians in Rome. For what can be known about God is plain to the Gentiles. He talks about Jews and Gentiles. This is the Gentiles. For what can be known about God is plain to Gentiles, non-Jews, because God has shown it to them. Well, how did God do that? Ever since the creation of the world, his eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through what? Through the visible world. This is what's called natural theology. So they are without excuse. The Gentiles, even though they don't have the Torah, they don't have the law, they don't have God's revelation that way, they're still without excuse, for though they knew God through nature, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. And they became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling a mortal human being or birds or four-footed animals or reptiles or anything else weird out there. That's the same argument that Luke says Paul made at the Areopagus. So, there's some grounds here. Luke may have written the speech, but he seems to be drawing on memories of Paul. Again, contrary to Luke's report, a casual statement in 1 Corinthians lets us know that there are in fact no converts in Athens. And this one's pretty clear. Now, brothers and sisters, you know that members of the household of Stephanas were the first converts in Achaia. Achaia is a geographic area. Now, Athens is in Achaia. Paul then goes to Corinth, which is in Achaia. And where did his first converts come from? They come from Corinth. So it's clear that the first converts in this area were from Corinth, not from Athens. So this is one of those places where Paul and Luke just have a different understanding of that. Paul is going to spend 18 months in Corinth. And it's going to be the base of operations. The only place he's ever going to spend more time than this will be at Ephesus. He'll spend 2.5 or 3 years there. So next week, we're going to follow Paul as he now goes across the isthmus there, the Peloponnese. He will move into Corinth and discover there are already Christians in Corinth. Pre-Paul. How did they get there? We have a couple minutes. Any thoughts, observations? Random questions? Yes, Paul?
Why was he not thrown out of Corinth?
He gets thrown out of the synagogue and he moves down the street and rents a lecture hall. So he gets thrown out, but he doesn't quite leave the town. Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, there's a little, we'll get that next week. He has loyal enemies who are loyal to persecuting him. Okay. What's that?
That's how we treat whistleblowers, right?
Yeah, that's how we treat whistleblowers. Okay, yes, yes. What?
Question, did he get thrown out of Athens?
I thought it was Corinth.
Corinth.
Athens, we don't have a record he got thrown out of. Okay. He just leaves when they say, we want to hear more.
And he leaves.
And some scholars say, because sometimes people can say sarcastically, well, why don't you tell us some more about that? And you realize you're not getting anywhere with him. And he seems to have understood that he's getting nowhere. And by the way, even in Luke's narrative, Paul will never again take the intellectual approach to the faith. How many intellectual people do you convince by an intellectual argument? Not many, yes.
So I think sometimes the words arguing, questioning, mob mentality somewhat bother me, because the fact that you have a different opinion doesn't necessarily mean that you're wrong and you're right. You know, we challenge anyone to not say that at some point in their life they were on one side when somebody else was on another side.
Yeah.
And you know, people's things through history that have changed have come from people who dissent.
Yeah. Luke's pretty consistent that's his presentation. And I don't think it's just a translation issue, because Paul admits, how many times was he beaten by rods? How many times did they try to kill him? How many times?
But yet he's still good, but he still keeps his Jewish faith. And
yeah.
The other thing, too, is like sometimes I feel like then and even today, you know, we think we know something by someone else's viewpoint.
Yeah. It's interesting that Luke and Paul both seem, and see if you think I'm right on this, Luke and Paul both seem to indicate that Paul was not the easiest person in the world to get along with and could be perceived to be abrasive. Yeah. But on the other hand, we get these stories of converts coming out of it.
Yes.
So he's not running everybody off. But yeah, you have that dual, some are responding, some are rejecting. Some things never change.
But those kind of personalities are usually the catalyst for the change, too.
Okay.
Because they don't follow the herd mentality.
Yeah.
And they're not complacent, and they don't falsely accommodate those other situations. So they really evoke that kind of disruption that's so critical to make the change.
Yeah. Because buying into what Paul says would be perceived by others as disruptive, because it's not the status quo.
Right.
Okay.
Is this name of the Areopagus, is that the same thing as the Acropolis?
No.
Because
Okay, you've got a hill. The Acropolis, Acropolis in the Greco-Roman world is always the top of a mountain. That's what an Acropolis is. And it's all of the temples to the gods. That's all it is. The Areopagus in Athens is, as you're looking up at that, it's off to the left, about 100 yards over there, and it's the edge of it's a little rise, and it's the edge of a cliff that looks down several hundred feet down to the forum down below. So they're adjacent and they're connected, but it's not up on the top, right? Yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah, because the question is, what's the distinction between the Gentiles and maybe Hellenistic Jews? Here's the complication. The word that you hear, Greeks, is used for both. Okay? So you have to look at the context. Is a Greek a Greek-speaking Jew who's Hellenized, or are we referring to a Gentile who's never been Jewish? And the problem is the same word is used for both. It's like the word for Judean, living in the Judean area, and a Jew, religious. The word is the same word. So you have to look at the kind of context of that. So, and sometimes it's not totally clear. Except from here, you can see if he converts Jews and then Greeks, he's converting Greeks, clearly that's a Gentile. Did they have what?
Did they have Jewish DNA, or were they?
The synagogues would have a core of Jews, and by the way, these are all Hellenistic Jews. If you're outside Palestine, you're not a Palestinian Jew, and you're a Greek-speaking Jew of the diaspora. And then you had the Theosebon, the God-fearers. They are no Jewish heritage whatsoever. They are clearly Gentile, Romans, Greeks, attracted to what they hear, and they're attending, like we have people attend our church that not necessarily don't have any of our beliefs, but they're interested in what they see, and they come and they check it. It's that same kind of thing is going on.
Okay.